Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like mugs at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
Hello everyone.
It is episode 87 and it is the 23rd of November. We've got a huge show for you guys coming up. We've got...
87, very unlucky number for Australian batsmen, for the cricket fans out there.
All three of them that understand that reference.
Fun facts.
Thank you, Pete, for the fun fact at the start of the show. Sorry, episode 87, we've got a huge show for you coming up. We've got the kids show. We're going to be talking to Luke Kazanov. He is doing work experience with the IPA this week. We're going to be talking about what he sees at universities, what he sees at the high school, how he sees Liberty at high school grounds at the moment. And we're also going to be talking to Maxim Bashev, who had an article in the latest edition of the IPA Review, a really fascinating article talking about his great-grandparents' experiences under Leninism and Stalinism. That's a really interesting chat, talking about how the state was just absolutely crushing their right to think for themselves and how they were told to toe party lines, etc. Really cool chat, kid show.
A really useful,
Show.
Show. A youthful influence
Pete
on our
show. Pete is off to a hot start dated cricket references and the inability to think of the word shows. But
that
I reckon he'll pitch it up.
Not dated.
I think it is. But anyway, let us talk about it. So this is we'll start with this. So graph in yesterday's Hey What Did I Miss email. Make sure you guys are subscribing to that from ipa.org.au. Morgan Begg, friend of the show.
Frenemy
of the show. Did some really cool original research finding that the government has already passed 1,106 more pages of legislation than it did in all of 2017. Mm-hmm. Now, that's despite all the leadership instability and et cetera. So that is quite concerning, Pete.
Mate, that is a bit of a worry. So there was 3,707 pages passed last year. Already this year, 4,813. That's federal legislation. Doesn't include the states and local governments. And it's only November.
Yeah.
As you
They've got a whole nother month.
They've got a whole nother month. Morgan said there are still a few sitting days left, so there's still time to push for the record, although the record is 8,000 or 9,000, so that would require a big end to the year.
Yeah, but, you know, I believe they'll have it in them. The first one there is, like, whenever people say, oh, there's government instability, and there's always just that sort of thing of, like, oh, maybe this is a good thing, because if they're fighting against each other, they can't get together and pass legislation.
Correct, absolutely correct.
And apparently that's not as big an effect as we think it is.
Unfortunately, it's not. Of course, there's an example.
I was going to say, unless, you know, it is a good effect, and we could have had the record set this year quite easily if they were united.
That's right.
Like if it's 4,000.
Maybe there's less than there would have been.
Yeah.
So good on you for finding the positives.
Sliding doors. Anyway, you were going to say something.
Well, I was. There's the famous example of Belgium where their government was in crisis for months and nothing happened and their economy went gangbusters.
Yeah, they didn't have a government. They didn't have a government. The economy went up.
Yeah, I mean, they still had like a government, but they weren't doing anything.
I like to think of it as Mad Max Thunderdome.
Okay.
Everyone really did
Belgium style.
Belgium style Thunderdome. Anyway, and it's something I say on this podcast a lot, but again, I will take this opportunity to remind our listeners that this is a Liberal government passing all this legislation.
Yep.
Liberal government.
That is correct.
Don't forget that.
The pages legislation thing is a rough proxy as well for those out there.
So if you do want to see the graph, because Morgan compares it with all of the years past, dating back decades, that is, again, available at ipa.org.au. Make sure you subscribe to the Hey, What Did I Miss email. All right, another one for you. So this morning, Kurt Wallace, new staff member at the IPA, already a friend of the show, so make sure you're going back and listening to that one. He's heading up all of our IR, industrial relations, sharing economy, gig economy, that sort of stuff. He's had a report come out just in time for the Victorian election tomorrow, talking about the Daniel Andrews government's approach to the sharing economy, and it is not a good one. So you can go read the report on our website, but basically he's saying that regulations are hitting the labour hire industry, proposals to tackle wage theft. All of these are getting together. They're going to really stop the sharing economy taking off as much as it can in Victoria. And the sharing economy is such a great way of getting people into work, getting people more work, making sure people are paid.
That's right. That old, you know, wage theft fallacy, you know, there's no wage when you're unemployed, is there?
Mm.
So that's a real thing. Well.
Yeah, exactly. So Kurt Wallace in his media release says, the rise of the sharing economy has benefited thousands of Victorians by providing flexible work opportunities, helping individuals find work around their commitments and alleviating unemployment and underemployment. It's also had a positive impact on the lifestyle of Victorians, particularly with changes in eating habits. Thank you, Uber Eats, for keeping me fed for these last few years. And the way people... That's not Kurt. Kurt's got a very healthy diet. I do not. And the way people move around cities. Sorry.
Go on.
No, you go.
It really is just taking something cool and ruining it, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like, all of these people are really enjoying Uber Eats, Deliveroo, Uber, anything else you want. Airbnb, and yeah, we're just going to get rid of that because unions.
Let's go back to when you couldn't get a taxi in the city after.
I was thinking about that the other day. Like, I remember going to like high school parties. I remember going to high school parties and getting a cab in suburbia would be like, that's an hour. And Uber is just like three presses of a button, I'm back in the conversation.
Yeah, and they would just be like, where are you going? And if it wasn't on their way home, they'd just be like, nah, sorry, mate, can't help you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Airport, they were great days.
Okay.
Bring them back.
Exactly. And this links us to... if you do want to go read the report, that is on the IPA website right now. And Kurt's article accompanying the report is first time published as a member of the IPA, which is very, very cool. That's in the Spectator Australia. So again, ipa.org.au if you want to read that.
Big result for Special K. It was great.
Is that his nickname now?
It is, yeah.
All right, cool.
I just made it up.
The head of nickname department?
I genuinely am.
All right.
All right, so...
Well, this links us quite nicely, Pete, into the At What Cost report from the Institute of Justice.
That's right. Very good segue, James. Occupational licensing is what we're talking about here. Occupational licensing. Institute of Justice in the United States found that occupational licensing red tape cost the American economy at least 1.8 million jobs a year and up to $7.1 billion in lost output. Of course, you know, you all see in the United States these stories about licensing. We're not talking about brain surgeons and stuff like that.
Yeah, do you want to talk about what occupational licensing is?
Yep, that's what I'm doing.
Sorry. And, just making sure. Staying on track.
We're talking about how, you know, for occupations you need a license to practice, and it's not always stuff like being a brain surgeon where you think it's probably quite reasonable.
Yeah, I would like a brain surgeon to go to at least one college.
I'll let the market decide. And but it's stuff like hair braiders. We always do these stories, you know, in Louisiana, you have to have a bloody license to be a hair braider, stuff like that. So that's what we're talking about. Often safety is given as an argument for licensing, but this is just a fallacy for people who are trying to protect their jobs.
Yeah, so what it is, it's like all the hair braiders get together and say, actually, you need a license to do what we do, which stops any new entrants coming into the market, just protects their necks.
That's right, and it stops price competition. It's very hard to get a single number on how many licenses there are here in Australia, but we have done a study on it. Daniel Wall did a study on it in May, and he found some very good examples, which you should know about. Beekeepers in New South Wales, South Australia, Victoria, and Western Australia need a license. Beauticians in New South Wales, blackjack dealers in Tasmania. Yep, that's why I lost all my money, because the blackjack dealer was not licensed. Now, this is my favourite. Introduction agents or professional matchmakers in Victoria and in Queensland require a licence. So there's some group of bureaucrats sitting there going...
It does Tinder have a licence?
You know, this is what you need.
That's what I want to know. Does the algorithm to decide Tinder have a licence?
Well, I don't know. But if you are an actual person, you need a licence. And can you imagine them sitting around deciding what the rules are for the, you know, the perfect relationship?
Yeah.
What's she looking for? Yeah. I don't know. Taxidermists in Victoria, New South Wales, and Tasmania
also need a license.
Yeah, it's not like the animal's going to make a complaint, is it? So
it's not like the brain surgeon patient's going to make a complaint if it's a bad license. I don't think that's the argument. So the report shows, like, in America, as Pete says, between 6.2 billion and 7.1 billion in lost output due to all these people that could have a job and don't.
Yep.
1.8 and 1.9 million jobs could be created tomorrow if the occupational licensing went. And this was interesting. So licensing may cost the economy between $183.9 and $179.3 billion each year in misallocated resources.
That's right.
That's a spicy meatball. It is.
Yeah.
It's a lot of money.
It is.
Really interesting report. Go to the Institute of Justice to read more about it. And occupational licensing, it's such an interesting issue.
It is. If I could just make one more point about occupational licensing.
Nah.
One of the major changes, if you want to talk about how important occupational licensing is, in India in the early 90s, they got rid of heaps of their licensing, which was massive, and millions of people got lifted out of poverty.
Fantastic.
Very important to note that.
Very, very important indeed. All right, let's move on to another issue. So, the EU, for so many years, a lot of people who were against the EU were called conspiracy theorists when they started to say how the EU wanted to like ruin all the countries, become an empire of its own. Turns out they were right. So this week it came out that the EU was thinking of making an army.
Yeah.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel has said a common European army would show the world that there will never be a war between the European nations. Guy Verhofstadt, hope I pronounced that right.
Yeah,
he's an influential... influential EU politician from Belgium. He said, I'm very pleased that both Merkel and Macron are now fully behind a European army. We fought for this for many years. In the world of tomorrow, we have to take our destiny into our own hands. Which does sound like one of the first lines of dialogue from a terrible Tom Cruise movie.
That's real.
But it's actually what Guy Verhofstadt thinks. And then you've also got the French finance minister, Bruno Le Maire, says Europe needs to become the kind of empire like the China and the USA. Technological power, economic, financial, monetary, cultural power will be decisive. Europe can no longer afford to shrink from exercising its power and being an empire of peace.
That's pretty dark stuff.
Again, this is the starting montage from a dystopian apocalyptic future film.
Well, yeah, I mean, remember the last guy who wanted the pan-European army? Well, this is pretty dark stuff from the EU people. Now, you were right when they raised that. Try and keep it together here, James.
Sorry.
Were they?
It's quite funny.
What was I going to say? Yes, as they say, it's this little Englander conspiracy theory, you know, that they make fun of these people for saying, "Oh, the EU are going to want an army one day," and they were right.
Mm. So yeah. So what I think this comes from is all these EU politicians. No, at their, you know, they know in their heart, eventually, like, they still need Donald Trump's army. And that would just eat at them.
Yeah, that would
eat at them that he does have that power.
Yeah,
like, when we talk about that NATO meeting where everyone was, like, yelling at Trump, we know what was being said now. Like, you still need us.
He was, you know, you guys should have to pay your share.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, we'll just build our own army.
Yeah.
Now, here we are.
Also, would this be the most inefficient army of all time?
It would,
Because that would be a bureaucratic. There would be more bureaucrats than actual soldiers.
Because, I mean, Europeans have different languages and cultures.
I'm not talking, I'm just talking about how bad the EU is if you gave them also an army.
Yeah, well, I agree.
I don't think it's a language barrier. I think it's just,
it's more like they love taking orders of each other.
Yeah.
Like French people love taking orders from Germans. And,
oh, they, you know, nothing, vice versa. Nothing gets them going more. Yeah, so that was a really funny one. Yeah, European army. What a day.
So there we go.
All right, shall we talk some firefighters?
Yep. Oh, now this was a really interesting story during the week, which you probably would have seen actually. But that's right, we're going to talk about it anyway.
Yeah. Never stopped us before.
It's not stopped us before. Kim Kardashian and Kanye West hired a, well, they didn't hire, they, I think they probably did hire. Their insurance company gave them a...
Yeah, so like it's like the insurance that they've signed up for includes private firefighters.
Private firefighters. Very well said, James.
Thank you.
So there's obviously a wildfire in California near their house. Their house was under threat. But the house was worth $60 million, which is pretty good. And they got private firefighters to help protect the house. The headline community writing... So obviously there was outrage about this. I'll read out a few headlines. Kim Kardashian's private firefighters expose America's fault lines, said The Atlantic. As California's wildfires rage, the ultra-rich hired private firefighters, said HuffPost, and Vice said rich people pay for private firefighters while the rest of us burn.
Mm.
So I've got a few points about this.
Can I have another one here?
You go for
just
it,
to the headline writing community. So this one was from The Atlantic. Firefighters are consistently ranked the most beloved public servants, not just because they look good on calendars, but because they get their own. They treat everyone equally. Rich people don't get their own better firefighters, or at least they aren't supposed to. Historian Amy Greenberg tells The Atlantic. Now, aside all the stuff that we're going to talk about, how did The Atlantic's first call for a quote go to historian Amy Greenberg? Like, we've got this whole thing about Kim Kardashian and Kanye West firefighters. Get a historian on the line.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway,
that's
continue
an interesting,
on.
Interesting decision. Very well raised. My answer to this is, how good's America?
Yes.
Well, why don't we have private firefighters?
Yeah.
We've got more bushfires than them.
Yeah. So this is what I don't get about these headlines is your solution to Kim Kardashian and Kanye West getting private firefighters the fact that the state should have sent their firefighters away from families that can't afford firefighters towards saving Kim Kardashian's house?
Yeah.
Like, they're outraged that other people also got fire help when Kim Kardashian could have just had a monopoly on it.
Yeah, so rich people pay more, and that's bad.
Yes.
But they should pay their fair share in other ways.
Yes.
No, well...
Oh, you've got it.
Yeah.
You've nailed it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. But the thing people have to realise is, like, the private sector's good, right?
Yeah.
The private sector will do something better than the public sector. So, and everyone agrees on that when we're talking about red Ferraris. When we talk about important stuff like firefighting or education or health, it's suddenly people go lose their nana.
Yeah.
Like, this lose is their better. Nana. Kim and Kanye, right? So innovation and competition leads to better outcomes, right?
Yeah.
In firefighting, better outcomes is saved lives. So Kim and Kanye are saving lives.
Yeah.
By engaging the private sector.
Done. Hopefully they get invited to one of their parties. All right. That is...
They agreed to an interview. But
yeah.
we could ask them. That might help.
If we ever had got Kanye on this podcast... I'd quit the next day. Like, I've peaked. That is it for me. I'm done. Hopefully it's anything like that interview he had with Trump.
Yeah.
He just started ranting about whatever.
We'll keep trying.
One day, one glorious day. And he might, like, who knows? Like, you can't predict that guy. Now, all right, that is it for the start we're going to be talking about at the start. Let's go to those interviews with Luke Kazanov and Maxim Pashev. Before we do, we'll run through a few of the things the IPA has been up to. So I've already talked about Kurt Wallace's report that's available on our website and also through his article in The Spectator Australia. We've also got Daniel Wilde in The Spectator Australia talking about the the federal government's proposed $2 billion small business loan scheme and why that's the wrong response to Australia's small business crisis. The IPA has done a whole lot of work showing how business entry rate has fallen across Australia. Government loans are not the problem. We've also got Scott Hargraves reviewing Nassim Taleb's new book, Skin in the Game, I think is a new book. So he reviewed that in the IPA review, the article Stick Your Neck Out. Cool. Sorry. Thank you guys so much for listening and subscribing. We are available on iTunes, Spotify, through the IPA website, any podcast app that you choose to listen to shows through. So, I mean, obviously you are listening to the show right now through a podcast app that you choose, but so can your friends and family. So make sure you're going out and telling your friends and family to download the show to spread the word and we'll get more listeners. And if you are listening through iTunes, make sure you're leaving us that 5-star rating. Really helps us out with the ratings and the iTunes chart rankings. All right, Nina, if people aren't a member of the IPA yet and they listen to this podcast and they go, I want to become a member, or maybe they are a member now and they want to donate, we do have the IPA's end of financial year Christmas appeal coming up. So where can people go to donate?
Well, if you want to donate, just visit the website ipa.org.au, or for Christmas appeal, just ipa.org.au/Christmas. If you want to become a member, or you want to sign up someone else that you know that would love to become a member, just click on the join button, and starting as low as $22 per year, you can become one of the loudest voices of freedom in Australia.
Very cool. Let's go to those interviews now. Okay, we now welcome on to the show. This is very exciting. Our work experience kid for this week, Luke Kazanov. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having
me. Our work experience kid. What an intro.
No, thank you for coming on to the show because, you've been very good this week.
Thank you.
You should see some of the stuff he's been helping out with the podcast. It was very informative. Oh. Much better than my notes for the podcast. So thank you, Luke.
But these pages of notes. It's like, well, what do I do with this? Am I meant to read? Am I meant to read all this? Come on, Luke.
So very cool. So you're doing work experience with the IPA. So what made you want to work with the IPA?
Yeah, so unfortunately for like a lot of conservative students, like whether you're in high school, in university, wherever you are, like there aren't many outlets or communities for conservative students just by virtue of the fact that like in educational institutions, there are like so few conservative thinkers. There are so few ways to get your ideas out. And when you eventually do, you often meet a lot of criticism. So like the IPA is a fantastic avenue for like people, whether or not they're like young or old, but like interested in conservative thought. So that's what really got me interested in the IPA. I visited an event with Matthew Lesh at the start of this year where they discussed the dangers of identity politics. And then I was really hooked and really wanted to come here and help out. And I've had a fantastic week.
And who's been in charge of you this week?
Oh, well, so I've had help from James, especially.
That would have been.
And Nina.
Does that mean...
Everyone, really.
Does that mean James has to, like, do a report back to your careers teacher or something?
Oh, God, I hope not.
I hope not as well.
I've not been taking notes.
I haven't told them I'm here. I've told them that this is some greenie think tank, just so that I don't meet any criticism.
Oh, yeah. So you did a lot of work on social justice and you saved three whales.
I did.
So,
I did.
Yeah, we'll go with that.
They're our whales. That's my line on whales. Anyway, carry on.
Yeah, cool. So how are you finding the IPA? Is it we meeting expectations? Like, are you doing things that you thought, oh, I didn't know the IPA kind of did this stuff?
What I was really shocked by was like the output of the IPA. So like to think that such like an institution with like, you'd think that there'd be hundreds of people here. There really aren't. But like to think that you're publishing books, publishing reports like every week, email lists, events, it's like an amazing level of output for the amount of people here. And that's what's really shocked me.
What a guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great guy. He's seen me in action and that's why I'm seeing the output. Luke, can I ask a question? You're involved with Generation Liberty.
Yeah, so I'm involved with Gen Lib. So being under 25, so like anyone can like join the IPA, obviously, which is fantastic. The events that are open to us are also great. And obviously the work experience opportunities are fantastic as well.
And has it been a vehicle for you to meet other liberty-minded young people?
Yeah, so this idea of the IPA being like a community is really fantastic. Because especially at school, it's sometimes quite difficult to like express the opinion you have, given there's such a sort of shallow pool of opinions out there, which are often quite dominated by the left. Like, I think a study found that in US universities, 18% of tutors and professors identified as Marxists.
Really?
Like, one in five. That's absolutely shocking. So, like, it's often quite difficult to, like, express that opinion. So, Gen Lib's been really great.
How old are you?
By I'm 15.
Are you absolutely sure about that?
I'm absolutely sure.
Coming with stats and data and all that, like, evidence. I'm doing air quotes.
Yeah. No, that's fantastic. So, let's talk about your own journey. So, you talk about how you're really interested in conservative thought. You're really interested in these ways of thinking that you're not necessarily getting at school. So, what was your path to caring about politics? Is that something from a young age? Is it something new?
Yeah, of course. So it's been quite recent. I think that, like, it's not just me. There are, like, a lot of people who are part of this broader wave of, like, conservative thought, especially among adolescents. But, like, in a way, that movement has nothing to do with the IPA. The impetus behind it isn't, like, Sky News. But, like, it's actually the left who we have to thank for this, right? Because, like, we're sort of a product of their own unwillingness to, like, yield to other forms of thought. So, like, when we go to school and we've got no conservative thinkers, when we go to school and we've got no conservative opinions with which we are confronted, the only option for us is to, like, seek those out through other avenues, such as the IPA, such as, like, watching Ben Shapiro videos or whatever on YouTube. So, like, in a way, it's we're a product of the left, and that entire movement is. So, like, we are, in a way, the necessary concomitant of their sort of intellectual oppression.
Yeah, so for your one, so you're getting all this stuff from schools, and then you in your heart, you're just going, hang on, that doesn't match up with how I'm perceiving the world. And so you go out and you find the Ben Shapiro, you find the IPA stuff. Is that your experience?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, we've got all these, like, really riveting pundits, like, at our fingertips. We've got people like Ben Shapiro, Jordan Peterson, who are really amazing. And that's something the left sort of hasn't quite tapped into. Because, like, if you think about it, coming home from school on a Friday, and it's not just me, there are dozens of students who do this, who come home from school and they'll, like, go on YouTube and watch, like, Ben Shapiro Destroys Liberal, volume 384 or whatever.
Yeah, they're clocking up
Jordan Peterson. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. But, like, you'd never really think of coming home and, like, watching some Bernie Sanders or reading, like, a Guardian article by Clementine Ford about, like, the patriarchy.
No, I've got a housemate that does do that all the time. Sorry, there is at least one.
Could I quickly ask, so you mentioned a few commentators there. Do you have a favourite and why?
So, interestingly, what really started me off was Milo.
Okay.
I actually went and saw him in Melbourne. And what I was shocked by was the amount of young people there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this was last year, this time last year. And about 60% of the people in the room would have been under 25. And that was really shocking. So it started off with sort of Milo, as it did with many people, because he really is an entertainer.
Yeah, the gateway drug.
Exactly.
As he's known. Yeah. He is.
No, he is.
Yeah, but Luke has ended up with Ben Shapiro rather than exactly. You know, the alt-right.
So I think that, like, a lot of people eventually make that transition from what is, like, an entertainer to genuine academics like Ben Shapiro, Jordan Peterson, Dave Rubin.
Yeah, people that actually know what they're talking about.
Exactly.
But, yeah. So you started off with Milo, and then that sort of...
As did so many students at school.
And then that gets you into the other ones.
Of course.
Right.
Nice one.
Yeah, so we had a work experience kid a while ago, a friend of the show, Bo Sargent. So he was talking about how at school he had friends who weren't exactly political, but through the academics that you're talking about, Jordan Peterson, Ben Shapiro, et cetera, there was a lot of people that they didn't care about politics, but they're coming up to Bo going, oh man, I found this guy on YouTube. I don't know if you know about him, but he's amazing. Is that something you're experiencing at school as well? Is there people that, you know, didn't used to be involved in politics, sort of tuned out in the high school politics classes, but they're now starting to get involved?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, we just had a class in high school where we spent, like, 3 hours discussing feminism and modern feminism and sort of gendered language and all these sorts of things. And you'd be shocked because, like, the teacher was talking about these things thinking everyone would agree with him. And then all of a sudden, kids who you'd never spoken to, kids who probably don't even study, start talking about, like, how feminism is, like, how modern feminism is so dangerous and how it's terrible. And they're things that really shock you and surprise you about, like, this new wave of conservative thought, which is fantastic because it is a creation of the left. It's their panjandrums who think they don't really have to care about anyone else.
Yeah.
But, like,
what does that mean? Sorry.
Oh, so it's
I nodded my way through that. panjandrums, yeah.
People like Clementine Ford who think they have authority.
But what does that word mean?
So it's a person who thinks that they have sort of a certain degree of authority.
Okay.
Oh, okay. So we're panjandrums. So well, the Young Panjandrum Podcast.
Yeah, that they somehow have the expertise.
Yeah, okay. All right. So, and I think an interesting theme you sort of brought up there was that you thought the teacher would just assume that everyone agrees with them. I reckon that's a really, what's the word?
Panandrum.
True thing. Like an accurate observation. Yeah. Like people, often when you hit them with this stuff, it's like, hang on, I've never heard this anyone challenge my ideas before.
Absolutely. Like, there are so many teachers who are so dominated by the left, who don't expect sort of certain forms of thought coming from their students, and it's because they've never engaged with them, because like, we've never had a conservative discussion in class, and that's sort of statewide.
Yeah, yeah. Really dangerous. I mean, I think I told this story on the podcast before, but I remember when I was doing at uni, we were talking about the global financial crisis, and the teacher started going like, "Oh, it's because these unregulated banks were just running wild with other people's money."
It was because of regulation.
Yeah, that's what I said, and it was literally the first time he'd ever encountered the thought that there might have been too much regulation.
Hang on,
and
what?
I have never done a day's worth of economic study in my life. Like, to that point, I was just, you know, free speech and that's about it. And I was like, look, if me then just saying that is the first time you've ever experienced it and you don't have a counter, like, what are they teaching you to teach?
Yeah.
Like, how little other scope are you learning from?
Yeah, there's just no dominance.
And then you're just, like, regurgitating it out to people that, you know, don't think either.
It's just complete dominance. Yeah. There's no bearing voices.
I also want to go back to your specific story where, like, this is a question more for Pete, but based off Luke's story. Pete, how much money do I have to pay you to go to a high school, like a high school politics class where a male teacher is teaching a bunch of male students about feminism?
Well,
I reckon $900.
I'm pretty cheap, so like, you're not, you know, doing that much with your
Sunday hours. Yeah, that sounded like the absolute pit of hell.
Yeah, yeah, that does sound awful.
To bring this interview back to some sort of structure. So, you have a lot of people in your school that are now getting into these kind of thoughts. So you'd be pretty optimistic about the future with all these students that are now starting to get onto these ways of thinking.
Absolutely. But like, the thing is with this, it's like, I think you've referred to it like in some IPA review as the soft bigotry of the left. And that's like what a lot of these students haven't quite experienced yet. But when they do, they're quite shocked by it. Like, I know that Simon Breeny went to a high school and he was debating free speech with Julian Burnside. And Julian Burnside told him, like, shove your free speech up your ass and F off.
Mm.
Like, he actually said that to him in front of a room of students who'd never experienced anything like that before.
I'm sure they experienced that kind of thing before. Well, like, maybe not from Julian Burnside.
Not from Burnside. A QC. Yeah, exactly.
I'm sure that's been said.
Gonna have to disagree with you there.
Probably not from a QC,
yeah.
Which is, like, why they were so surprised. And I think that's what a lot of students are, like, thinking. And that's probably the future of conservative thought is going to be these students, these iconoclasts who are, like, a step above.
So you're optimistic.
I am, but also quite afraid.
Oh, okay.
Because ultimately, the fact that there is such little of actually a sharing of opinions and ideas means that the conservatives who we do have, and indeed the liberals who we do have, are often quite fringe, are often quite, like, extreme. So, like, if I hadn't found Ben Shapiro or Jordan Peterson, I probably would, in all honesty, still be listening to Milo Yiannopoulos or, like, Proud Boys or whatever other people there are out there. So, like, to a degree, the fact that there are no moderate conservative opinions pushes people of a conservative affliction toward really quite extreme opinions. And that's quite dangerous as well.
Yeah, but like, you know, you're going through this right now. And when I was going through high school, there wasn't even a Ben Shapiro or a Jordan Peterson to show.
Of course.
It wasn't even YouTube when I went to high school.
There wasn't even internet.
It was like, anyway, I don't want to get sidetracked with a Pete's old story, so you carry on.
Pete would just, you know, talk about politics on the rickshaw back home. But In a sense, like, there aren't as many as there could be, and hopefully there are more in future, but the fact that there are some these days, and through YouTube, there's just so accessible.
Of course.
Yeah.
But I think there are way more than you'd expect. Because the thing about conservatives is, like, we're not really concerned about what other people are whinging about, right? We're not bothered by other people's problems. That's why there aren't many, like, conservative protesters, because we're concerned about our own lives, our own problems, our own freedom, which means that we're a lot less vocal. Like, compared to, like, liberals who are, for example, protesting all the time about whatever problem exists. So, like, that leads us to often underestimate, like, a lot of the grievances that, like, conservatives have, and also, like, the sheer numbers that they have.
I would have to disagree that conservatives don't care about other people's problems. I think conservatives care deeply about other people's problems. But I think the protest thing is an interesting point.
Yeah, of course.
And that is maybe... You don't think the government can solve your problems? Well,
yeah, exactly. Also,
that's a better way to phrase it.
Or,
yeah.
Or just like the performability, like the left more than the right, I would say, care that other people see that they believe in things.
Exactly.
That's deep.
Yeah.
I think what it is that we're not as concerned by how other people live their lives as we are living our own life as freely as possible.
Mm. All right, cool. So, Luke, I know you are off to Sky News with Gideon Rosner. So we're going to let you go.
I'm very excited.
Luke, thank you so much. 15-year-old work experience kid. I do not believe any word of that.
No.
But thank you very much for coming on the
show.
We'll have
so
you back on.
Thanks so much for having me. I've had a great time.
Thanks, Luke.
Great. Okay, we now welcome on to the show. This is a very interesting one. So we've got Maxim Beshev. Now, Maxim, you are a Year 11 student, and you're also a contributor to the IPA Review, which is very impressive first up. So very cool. All right, let's talk about the article. So it is talking about your grandparents and their experiences under communism. So first off, what inspired you to write this article?
So this is from the latest edition of the Review.
It is from the latest edition of the IPA Review.
Just for those wondering.
Yep.
Well, thank you for having me on the podcast, and I really appreciate it, and I appreciate that you published it. What inspired me to write it was when I went to Leningrad, which is now called St. Petersburg. It was called Leningrad under communism in Russia. It's the second largest city in Russia, and I went there in July of last year, and I found it to be probably the most beautiful place I've ever visited. And I've been to Paris, and I find that to be an overrated tourist destination, to be honest. And,
coming in from the top row already into this interview.
The St. Petersburg is massively underrated. It's such a beautiful place. And then I realized that I actually had a great-grandfather who fought to defend this city, and like millions of others, he suffered a very severe injury. And then I spoke to my great-grandmother about their exploits under Stalin and under communism and how they were often brutally silenced and censored by the communist propaganda, and the ideology didn't allow them to speak their minds. And she was very interested in this, and I told her that there is potentially a similar thing developing in Australian politics, and particularly in Australian universities.
Terrific. So let's get into the article. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about your great-grandparents' story, because it's a very fascinating story.
Mm-hmm. Well, most of it is written in the article, but I can just sum it up for those people who haven't.
That'd be great.
Sure, sure. So my great-grandparents were born in the, I think, 1920s. So they grew up under the beginnings of communism in Russia, and they married after World War II. So before World War II, my great-grandmother, Anya, who is still alive and she's 91.
Wow.
Yeah. She lived in Vladivostok, which is a place in the very far east of Russia.
Can you say that again, please?
Vladivostok. Vladivostok, if you say it like in the English way.
Yeah, poorly.
If you say it poorly, it's Vladivostok.
That was good. That was very Bond villain.
City in the... Yeah, exactly.
Because they're always Russian. Anyway.
It's true.
Don't let my rubbish distract you.
Just let Pete have fun in his little corner. You and I have a serious conversation.
Just with you.
Yeah.
Okay, so... basically, she grew up in Vladivostok in the east of Russia, and it was a little fishing village. And when she was 15, World War II broke out in Russia. So that was 1941. And my grandfather, Dedushka Pavel, so his name was Pavel Gorfunkel, he lived in Leningrad. And then, of course, he was a bit older when he was 19 or so when the war broke out. And so he was immediately sent to, actually, it was on the day of his high school graduation that World War II was announced by Stalin, and then he was immediately taken with many other men, conscripted for military service, and taken to 6 months training at a special camp.
So a bit of a dampener on the old schoolies trip. Did they get the deposit back on the beach house?
To be honest, I don't know if they had schoolies back then. It's a bit expensive, especially if you have a socialist economy, to do schoolies. But yeah, so certainly it was unexpected. And so he was sent to 6 months training, and at that training they recognized that he could be officer material, so they promoted him to lieutenant at the age of 19, and he was, I think, at least in his division or some very large military group, the youngest person to be promoted to lieutenant, even before the fighting began for him. And then he was sent to the front, and he was tasked with defending Leningrad, and basically he was given all these supplies and men to lead. And there was one case 2 years later in 1943 when Leningrad, it's full of lakes and rivers, so the Nazis blockaded it. And it was very easy to blockade because it's surrounded by water and there's only little parts of it connected to land. So you only have to block off a certain very small section to starve the entire city. And so they were deactivating a bunch of mines so that food supply trucks could get through. And he stepped on one and it blew off a part of his leg. And then the people that he was with, the soldiers, they were under his command, and he instructed them that they should continue disarming the mines and cut off his leg. And they had no anesthetic, and he was aware of that. And still, he pulled through.
So let's talk about that, because in your article you say shortly after he gets back from the front, he takes up a position at the university, mm-hmm. he starts teaching, and that's where
He didn't start teaching straight away. He actually started studying a student first.
Yes, yeah. And he shortly meets your great-grandma.
Yes.
And so was he already... You say how the great-grandma, it's like, she's only told about Leninism, she meets a great-grandfather, she starts to realize, hang on, there's another way of thinking about things. Mm-hmm. Now, was your grandfather always a committed, he's not a fan of communism, or was it only after his experiences in the war where he started to really think about things a bit differently?
Honestly, I don't know that. I know that he was certainly against communism after the war. I don't know if he had a particularly strong opinion on it before the war, but obviously during this time, all Russians were... under the thumb of Stalin, and not just Stalin, but the entire Soviet leadership. And it was very, very brutal. And so the important thing that I outline, well, I try to, I say it's important, I don't know, it's up to people to decide how important it is, but I say that my great-grandmother goes from Vladivostok to Leningrad when she gets accepted into the university, and there she meets my great-grandfather, exactly like you said. They start studying philosophy and psychology together. And there they sort of form a bond, and they fall in love, and they marry a few years later. And during that time, he basically makes her realize, after all that he had seen, all the suffering and death that he saw in World War II on the Eastern Front, which was probably the worst part of World War II, the Eastern Front particularly, because it was also so cold as well as being so horrific. And, people see that... He saw there that people fought for each other. They didn't fight for any kind of ideology or any collectivist dictatorship. They had no interest in fighting for something that they had really nothing to do with and something that was dominating them. They were interested in trying to just improve the world in a small way and to stop the world from being run by fascist tyrants. So that's what it really came down to.
So what kind of stuff did your great-grandparents get up to at university? Because I know that they were, I believe, part of a kind of subversive group. Would that be correct?
Particularly my great-grandfather, yes. Particularly Pavel. My great-grandmother, Anya, was not as heavily involved, but she certainly supported him. And that group, were you going to ask what that group would do?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, well, basically, he started meeting with a bunch of friends, I think on a weekly basis, at night in a sort of shadowy apartment, and they would just discuss what the party was doing, and they would sort of openly criticize it. It wasn't any kind of hate group. They were just interested in discussing what good alternatives there were to communism. And that's something that nowadays in Australia, anyone can do. We can sit here and just do nothing but criticize the government all day, and nothing's going
to
happen.
Yeah, we do it every single Friday,
exactly.
Basically.
Yeah. Contractually obliged to. You guys seem to be doing pretty well.
Yeah.
Right, well, unfortunately, it wasn't so simple then, and... one time he couldn't go because he had to study for an exam, and it was actually my great-grandmother, Anya, who persuaded Pavel to stay and study for the exam because it was so important. And on that night that he couldn't attend, there was somebody who basically ratted them out and to the Soviet authorities, and they were all arrested, and none of them told on him, actually.
Wow.
Because they were all such loyal friends, except for whoever it was that told on them all.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring you to another part of your article where you talk about how in the education system, teaching people not to think was their means of keeping power.
So this is something that my grandfather, who is now in his late 50s, I think, said. He now lives in Melbourne. Lev, that's his name. He said that while he studied there, not so much while he studied there, but to some extent, because there was still the KGB and all these other internal investigations agencies that would basically ensure that most of what you said, or under my great-grandparents' generation, absolutely every word you uttered was strictly adhering to a certain type of ideology. And anything that challenged this was considered objectively wrong, which is a really smart tactic. You know, if you have to persuade people, then you say, well, look, Marxism has the solutions to all the problems you can imagine. So therefore, this is, of course, the way that they would kind of the communists would try to sell it like this. It's like, therefore, if you oppose Marxism, then you're just like, it's like saying that the sky is not blue. It's like, and they tried to back this up with a bunch of philosophical reasoning, which is about as oversimplified as some of the reasoning in, you know, modern universities about that, that is so clearly politically biased. So, yeah, that's the way I think I saw it.
You mentioned in your article one of the things which persuaded Russians and persuaded your relatives to turn against communism was actually pop culture and mm-hmm. hearing the Beatles and things like that. Do you want to talk about that a little bit more?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can mention two instances of that. The first was with my grandfather, who I mentioned in the article, and the second was with my dad, who I don't mention in the article. So I'll go through both. I'll go through Lev first. Lev listened to the Beatles music for the first time, and he said, wow, this is really nothing like that sort of typical propaganda music that we would listen to in the Soviet Union. It was obviously very catchy. The if you listen to the USSR anthem, it's quite an interesting anthem. But and all those, you know, communist songs, you know, they have something to them because you have to compensate for the terrible state with some kind of nice art. But it was nothing compared to the art of Western ideals and something that was sort of predicated on freedom and liberty. And that's what the Beatles were. They were this sort of freelance, sort of almost like a good type of gang of a music band. And then all these other Russian icons began to pop up when my dad was about my age now. So when my dad was my age, he told me these stories about Perestroika. Perestroika is something that happened in Russia around 1991 and a few years before that, when the Soviet Union was finally beginning to come apart. It was deceased in 1991. And so for the few years before that, from, say, 1985 or so, all these bands like Bravo and Aquarium, and most people don't know these like so well outside of the West, but everyone in Russia knows them well. Other ones like Viktor Tsoi and Kino, they all sort of sang these really Western-style songs, but with their own twist. And many of them were actually talking about, indirectly, like all songs, talking about the collapse of communism and how great it was for Russia. That finally Russians were free. And so there's one song called Train on Fire, which is about this general who comes to the front and he says, we've been waging this war for 70 years, it's time to go home. It's basically the idea that it's over. The whole totalitarian nightmare is finished and people can be free. And I don't think that Russia's free now. It's unfortunately, it's gone back to a sort of authoritarian regime, but under a right-wing government as opposed to a left-wing government. But it's certainly freer than it was under the Soviet Union. It's got free travel. You can go there as long as you don't make any kind of political opposition. You're actually quite okay in Russia nowadays.
Yeah, yeah. You say, it was the Beatles that got him into mm-hmm. Western music and made him think of some, there's another way. Do you reckon things would have been different if it was like Post Malone or Lil Pump? Or just would have gone like, you know what, maybe the West isn't for me.
No. He would have appreciated those mad beats.
And the dope bass. All right, we've heard different Post Malone songs. Or the Mo Bamba song that's really popular right now. That is atrocious. Anyway, so there's another one we're talking about here. So he also talks about how when they pursue equity, that's just the equity of making everyone else poorer. Do you want to expand on that one? Because mm-hmm. I thought that was a very, very good point.
Oh, well, yeah, they were both. They were equally poor. Like, that's the way my grandfather puts it. The thing is, my grandfather also said that socialism and capitalism, apart from one thing, have a lot in common. And the one thing that they have in common most is that they both try to make the world better. They just have different approaches to it. And one of them has been tried and tested throughout centuries to work, and the other has been tried and tested throughout the last century to fail. And the reason socialism fails is because if everyone, well, in the most simple terms, nobody works. Because if you're guaranteed a certain salary, regardless of whether you work more or less, of course you're going to do the minimum amount of work, and any work you do produce will be only produced because you're forced by threat of violence to do it, or because you're genuinely interested in what you happen to be doing. There is only one benefit to this that I can think of, and that is that people can actually study what they want in university rather than thinking about making money. But that's really the only benefit I see. Although that does explain why in Russia, during the Soviet Union, the STEM education was so good. And all these physics and maths Olympiads were being dominated by Russians. And so was chess and literature also being dominated by Russians in world competitions, because people could, very intellectual people who were also, you know, inclined a certain way, could try to essentially make the most of their talents. And that's one thing that I think we can sort of, that's like the one good thing that socialism ever produced. It was, apart from that, I can think of nothing else. But certainly one thing we should learn is that we have to find a way to make use of people's talents, and that's not always perfectly achieved under our current Australian system or under the Western system.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. There's a whole lot of people in universities just pursuing whatever they want without making money. So I think they're getting a fair bit of deal there as well. Anyway, I want to talk about a bit more of what you were saying there. So to bring it back to the start of the interview, you talked about how you see a similar thing happening at schools and universities. Now, like, that's one of those ones where 5 years ago, if you started a point, like, you see it's happening now, people might say, okay, like, they don't see it. But certainly now, I mean, you know, the stuff we're talking about now with Bettina Arndt getting charged security fees for some of her speeches and some of the violence, you know, it's not as bad as your great-grandfather just studying for an exam and not being off to the gulags, but you can sort of see the seeds being planted, I guess, that something might end up happening where that's as bad as it gets, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I'm optimistic. I think that in the end it'll all work out well, but certainly we are facing a threat. Not necessarily one as severe as it was in the 20th century, but anything that even approaches that is something we should be immediately wary of at minimum, and we should be doing everything we can to try to protect freedom of speech, particularly in a place that's made deliberately with the intention of encouraging intellectual inquiry, because a university is supposed to have people debate out difficult ideas, and if the ideas are all biased to such an extent, then it's actually not teaching people to be smart. It's not teaching people to think for themselves.
What about young people in general? We've seen a resurgence. I mean, do you witness in your age group a resurgence in support for socialism and stuff like that from people who might not understand what it's actually like? Or is that not the case?
Not so much among my friends, because it's not like I vet.
Because you tell them.
No. It's not like I vet people for socialist ideals before befriending them. But it's like I think that my friends are just so focused on themselves and trying to make, in a good way, as in trying to make things better on a small scale around them. And that's so much more achievable than just trying to, at the age of 17, telling the whole world how the economy should function. You know, that's certainly, and it's actually something you can do and something you can implement. Now, in terms of generally speaking, do I feel that there's a resurgence to socialism? In the university, certainly. Yeah, at Monash, because I go to John Monash Science School, and I often go to Monash University just by incidence, and there are constantly posters of Marxism. I've spoken to a religious leader there, and he said it's really troubling for him, you know, of course, because Marxism is so strongly atheistic. That's not the objection that I have about it, although I do dislike a very serious atheism. Like, I have nothing against people who don't believe in God. Like, I'm not particularly religious either, but the objection we have to the resurgence of Marxism and socialism, that religious leader and I, are different, but they're ultimately stemming from the problem that it doesn't allow for individual freedom. He takes issue with it primarily because it's so atheistic. It doesn't bother me so much that that's the case. I take issue with it primarily because it's authoritarian and it tells people how to live. And that's what I really don't like.
All right, cool. Maxim Bashev, the article is Rewarded for Not Thinking. It is available in the latest edition of the IPA Review. And if you aren't a subscriber to the IPA Review, that does come free with an IPA membership. So make sure you're becoming a member, as Nina will point out how you can do that later in the show. All right, Maxim, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you to Luke Kazanov and Maxim Bashev for those interviews. Really interesting chats. Let's fly through some stories that made us laugh this week, Pete. And I might start off, if I may.
Oh, yeah, may sorry.
Thank you.
That was rhetorical.
Well, no, I genuinely wanted to know if I could do it.
Collaborative.
Thank you. All right, let's talk about this one. Sorry, Leeds Trinity University in the UK. Now, we've had a fair few stories of UK students asking things not to happen, including the famous one of, can we please stop applauding? Can we instead have jazz hands? Because applauding can trigger anxiety, which again, I will say, like, nothing would make me more anxious than a room full of people just doing jazz hands at me if I ever said something. That would absolutely terrify me to my very core.
Terrifying.
Anyway, so new one for you. So according to UK media reports, the Leeds Trinity University teachers have been told to stop using capital letters, as well as the overuse of words do and don't when they're marking exams.
Yeah.
Because that's going to trigger anxiety. Capital letters.
That's right.
Proper English structure is anxiety creating.
That's right, yeah.
Your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts on this, James, is that this is a school of journalism.
Mm. Right? So this school, this university is specifically focusing on journalism.
Yeah.
What are these graduates going to do when their editor yells at them, can you knuckleheads get me some effing stories at, you know, 11 o'clock on a Tuesday?
Or just even like, why did you submit a 700-word article with not a single capital letter?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I forgot what they were. So there's we haven't used them for a while.
There's lots of things. The, I did see something there. What did I see? Oh, okay. So one of the justifications for this was... they often talk, so they, the students, often talk to each other, and any misconceptions or misunderstandings quickly spread throughout the group, in brackets, usually and in, aided and abetted by Facebook. This can lead to further confusion, and students may even then decide that the assessment is too difficult and not to attempt it. I reckon if they think it's too difficult and they're just not going to do it, maybe they're not in the right place.
To bring you back to what you just said before, it's like, so if this assignment, you just might not do it because it's too hard. What about, hey... like, there's an hour till deadline, but something happened. Write me 700 words right now.
Nah,
I might that's not. A little hard. We'll just let the other papers get to that story.
I don't know how. Why are they accommodating the people that might decide it's too hard and not do it?
Because...
I don't know.
I also like this. Sorry, Leeds Trinity University put out a statement saying, hey, look, we haven't banned capital letters. All these reports are saying we've banned capital letters. That's wrong.
Okay.
We've just said it's not best practice not to write it in capital letters.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, so
they're, like, they're the mafia. It's like, oh, we're not saying don't do that. We're just saying it'd be a real shame. It'd be a real shame if you were to use capital letters.
Yeah.
I'd hate to see it if you use capital letters.
I'd hate to see something happen to you. and they say write into a helpful, warm tone, avoiding officious language and negative instructions. Just to,
again, school journalism, like, that is a tough industry.
These people are meant to go out there and ruin people's lives. Like, that's what journalists do, isn't it?
Yeah, so, basically. That's my understanding of
anyway.
All right, cool. Pete, let's move on to another story.
Okay, look, next on my list is UK bans expensive, well, not UK, the UK school bans expensive coats.
So another UK school story.
Yeah, so this is a high school. Head teacher of Woodchurch High School in northwestern England, Rebecca Phillips, said that students coming to school in £700 coats, which I'm led to believe is...
spicy meatball.
Nearly $900, according to this. Says this wasn't a good idea.
Just one spicy meatball. Just say spicy meatball.
Okay. I'm not 100% clear on what that means, but okay, I'll take that on notice. This wasn't good. So the principal said this wasn't good for students whose parents couldn't afford such clothes. They feel stigmatized. They feel left out. They feel inadequate.
So my take with this is that is the school saying you are right to feel like a victim. Like, that, we talk about victim culture and, like, I'm being oppressed. The school is basically like, yeah, you're right. Anything you see in the world around you that makes you feel sad, you're a victim of that.
Yeah. Why can't they just say, oh, like, there's nothing wrong with not being rich?
Yeah.
And that it doesn't matter if you have nice clothes, it's what kind of person you are.
Yeah. Oh, Pete, that's so heartwarming coming into the Christmas season.
Well, I'm a pretty heartwarming guy. Yeah. So that's another one from the UK.
Yeah, very, very good. All right. I've got a third one from the UK. It's a UK special.
Yeah.
Now... so,
oh, there's more from the UK after this as well.
My God, there is actually.
What's happening in UK this week?
UK, get it together.
We do a lot as of a country. Stuff.
All right, so I've got another one here from the UK. So there's a movie coming out soon, The Grinch. Now, I don't think it's going to be a good movie.
Bolt likes movies, though.
I do like movies. Pete has seen two movies, and I've seen two movies today. The Grinch is coming out, and they're doing an advertising campaign around the London metro area. And so you're on a train, you're about to leave to like, so one of them is if you're leaving to the south of London, there's like a big Grinch poster and the Grinch is saying, welcome to South London, this is your last chance to turn around. And on the other side of the building to like North London, it says, you are now heading north of the river, try to contain your excitement.
Mm.
So, you know, kind of cheesy. It's the Grinch. He hates things. So it fits in with the character. Yeah. It's on brand.
Okay.
Until this has now started accusations that it's racist and classist, and a lot of people on Twitter are calling for a boycott for the film. Got one here.
Twitter, you reckon?
Twitter.
People on Twitter are getting upset.
Look, I don't want to alarm you, Pete, but people on Twitter are doing something stupid. James Asper quotes the South London, this is your last chance to turn around, and then he says, nope, not finding this funny, BF. IMAX Waterloo snobbery of South London is based on classist and racist stereotypes. Genuinely tried hard not to be a Grinch about this, but too much South London pride. You know, that got it off. We'll be boycotting the new Grinch film, says Hales, due to vile South London slander on the giant advert on the water roundabout. Now, the thing is, he's clearly a equal opportunity offender. North London's copping it, South London's copping it.
That's right.
It's the Grinch.
Yeah.
So to say that he's being racist, no, he's just being the Grinch.
Well,
he's the Grinch.
He's
the Grinch.
He's the real Grinch.
He's the Grinch. It's on brand.
The only thing to remember about the Grinch is that he's a made-up monster character.
That's also true.
He's not real.
Yeah.
True.
So that's another thing.
Facts
only.
Becoming
a real one.
Yeah, like if the Grinch can't be grinchy, then comedy's just dead. Like if you actually can't make fun of anything anymore,
yeah,
the Grinch is gone. Like comedy's gone.
And the other thing about this is that it's you're not, you don't think it's racist unless you are a little bit racist yourself. Mm. Like no one else is going like oh,
South
London.
Talk about dog whistles. Like oh, South London is a racist thing. Like that's a dog whistle.
Yeah,
yeah.
So yeah.
Well, my final one with this is:
is it going to be a good movie though?
I sincerely doubt it.
Okay.
Right. I don't know. I got a sixth sense of these things, I guess. Okay. It could be good. Could be good. Probably won't. But the other one I'm going to say is the Grinch is a thief of joy. Anything that people get happy about, Christmas, he will take away.
Yeah. So
why do the far left want to silence him? That he's their icon.
That's exactly right.
He is the thing that gives them life.
He's their homeboy.
Because he got the spotlight.
The homeboy.
That's what the kids say, isn't it?
My goodness. All right. On that note, let's move on to the dog.
So, this is quite funny. So they always talk about how there's an increase in hate crimes in the UK. They say we've seen a spike in hate crimes. We've seen a wave of xenophobia.
Yeah, especially after the Grinch advertising campaign.
Submerge the country after Grinch and after Brexit. You know, all these racists who voted for Brexit. 2,507 hate incidents from 2015 to 2016.
Which is a lot.
A lot. You know, that's a lot of things.
Huge if true.
Huge if... Well, that's... That is the question, James. In the UK, revealed in the 118-page document disclosed under Freedom of Information laws. And the thing about this 2,507 incidents are there are plenty of funny ones in there that perhaps wouldn't be thought to be hate incidents by the rest of the population. I'll give you some examples. An envelope that has been opened and resealed, hate crime. An incident involving a car that bore a remembrance poppy because... The woman, so there's someone backed into someone else's car, and the person whose car was backed into it had a poppy on it, and she said, they backed into me because I had a poppy. Hate crime. Disputed line calls in a tennis match. This guy said that his daughter was getting bad calls because of racism. A man telling library staff he was campaigning for Brexit. The library staff said that was a hate crime. Suspect's dog barking at a victim. Suspect. That's the kind of language we're using in this. Where's the other page?
Let's just say accused.
The accused. Bus driver gave a racist look. A woman, now this is funny, a woman thrown out of a pub for being drunk and aggressive and erratic told police that she'd been targeted because she was Polish. People who get chucked out of pubs never have, like, you know, wild conspiracy theories about why they're being kicked out of pubs.
I want to go back to the bus driver. The bus driver gave a racist look.
Yeah.
Like, when has a bus driver ever given a positive look to anyone?
Yeah,
like, what made it racist?
The bus drivers hate everyone.
Yeah.
They're colorblind.
Equal opportunity offenders.
Yeah, that's right. And in addition to this, right, in addition to all these claims, Scotland Yard has also withdrawn claims that it has 900 officers dedicated to investigating hate crimes.
Well, can we just go back to my favourite
non-hate
crime? An unknown dog. Unknown dog. Could be any dog.
Yeah.
An unknown dog has fouled outside of a victim address perceived this to be a racial incident.
What?
Dog just went poo-poo on someone's lawn.
Yeah.
Racial incident.
Yeah.
So the dog racist. The dog knows who owns the house.
Yeah, the dog's racist.
Oh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Why didn't he pick any other lawn?
Yeah, come on.
Yeah. Why not her lawn?
There's one thing I know about dogs is that they hold it the entire way until they get to that one person that they don't like's house.
Yeah, those dogs. It's not always, you know, up in your face anymore, but it's still there, just below the surface, just that discrimination. No, sorry for forgetting that, James. That was the main one. Yeah, now Scotland Yard has withdrawn claims 900 officers dedicated to investigating alleged hate crimes. And they were bragging about this. You know how like they were always kind of, yeah, oh, we're doing so much for hate crime. Well, they copped all this flack because they're like, why have you got 900 officers looking after hate crimes when London's like the murder capital of the world these days?
Yeah,
or the
knife crime attack.
I did a stabbing thing.
Well, I know what a knife is there.
Don't know why I did that. And so they took down all those tweets and said, actually... We don't have 900 officers. They're doing other stuff. They just do a little bit of hate crime every now and then. So.
Just like the idea of the social media coordinator looking at the responses, then walking into the room where all the 900 hate crime officers are and just go, guys, it's up.
Yeah. To go and do something else.
Sorry, we tried. Didn't take as well as you thought it would.
Yeah.
Go out there and solve some crimes.
The punters help. Want
They're like, damn it, we had the easiest job in the damn district.
Yeah. Yeah, they're on a real good wicket. Because anyway, so that's the wave of xenophobia that's flooding Britain as we speak.
Yeah, so and this brings into, you know, if I can make a slightly serious point about this and give it some something, but so the 2,507 hate incidents does sound like a lot.
Yeah.
And none of those are actual crimes. Like, you know, it's not a crime to give someone a bad stare. But the thing is, in the UK, they want to solve the issue of racism so bad that any complaint made to the police that is labeled as a hate crime by the person bringing the complaint has to be logged and transcribed and like kept on record, and that's a thing now.
Yeah.
Like anything.
Yeah.
Like a dog defacing someone's lawn is not a crime, but if you say it's a hate crime, they have to take care of it.
That's right.
So, like, that's the thing. It's like, is hate crime actually going up, or is just recordings of hate
crime?
It's
definitely
going
reporting.
Up.
Reporting's gone up heaps. Right. Another thing is, as we should always mention, this obscures actual racism.
Yes.
Because then anyone says, oh, I've been a victim of racism, people go, oh, no, that's rubbish.
Yeah, yeah. A dog just pooped on your lawn.
Yeah. And it might have been actual.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk the Trump bailout, Pete.
Oh, okay. Let's do it. So the US Department of Agriculture have got this program that they're bailing out farmers hurt by the trade war. They've sent payments to more than 1,100 people living in... So they've sent payments to farmers all around the country, but they've also sent payments to 1,100 people living in America's 50 largest cities, according to an environmental watchdog group. So in order to qualify for funds, an applicant has to show that they are actively engaged in farming, but actively engaged in farming definition is pretty loosely applied. The Washington Post highlighted how this fellow called Scott Yocum is an architect who lives in Manhattan, was able to qualify for a $3,300 bailout fund because he's the partial owner of a family farm in Ohio where he only spends 2 weeks a year. So I can't believe that the government has not been able to spend all this money prudently. Normally, they're really good at looking after stuff like that.
Yeah, there's no money going to the wrong areas. I got to say, that guy that gets $3,300 for going to a farm for 2 weeks, I'll do it for $2,700.
Yeah,
if you're looking to save some cash, give me $2,700, I'll go to a farm for 2 weeks.
If I can get on the end of the sweet, sweet bailout coin, I will do a veggie patch.
Whatever. We would be in so much favour of bailouts.
Yeah. Oh, we are.
Bailed out the podcast industry.
I am a big bailout guy. Do it as much as you want. So the White House announced the bailouts in August in response to Chinese retaliatory tariffs that targeted American farm products, and there should be $5 billion in bailouts this year.
That's a lot of money. Again, what am I describing that meatball as, Pete?
Spicy.
Thank you. But that is the thing. So whenever these big bail packages go up and everyone goes like, oh, you know, they're looking after your industry. Well, they're kind of looking after architects in Manhattan that have a family farm that they don't go to.
Yep.
Like, that's the thing. All right. Last one we got for you. This was an absolute train wreck of an interview. And Pete and I are going to become PR people. So this is James and Pete's PR firm. We're going to be looking at disaster interviews or instances where someone clearly needs a bit of a PR shot in the arm.
Because we understand how to manage a crisis.
Yes. And we care. And we care.
Yep.
So, So as we've said on the show before, Victorian elections are coming up on Saturday. Now, Liberal candidate for Frankston, Michael Lamb, he was on Sky News Spears. Ooh. I have no idea why, but he was there. And they are talking about energy. And I'm not going to say that Michael Lamb wasn't across his brief, but I'm also going to say that this is some of the audio from the interview.
Yeah.
So the government, the taxpayer would fund this.
No, it's private industry.
But they can do that already.
Well, they haven't.
So what would the government do?
Well, allow them to do it.
But with their own money?
Yes.
But they're allowed to do that now?
Well, they're not, though, are they?
Why not?
I don't know.
So hang on, I'm just confused. What changes?
What changes is we will tender to get the lowest base power we can get, and we'll get a power station built.
So, sorry, tender to purchase the power itself?
No, to build the power station.
But you're not building it?
No, the private sector will.
Okay, so... But the private sector can go and build a power station today.
Well, they haven't, though, have they?
And it continues on like that for a while. Like, you could not script that.
Like, that was tough listening. That was tough listening. I don't like the train wreck interviews.
No. I feel bad for them for a while, but then I just go like, oh, you knew that. Like, this wasn't like approaching him on the street. Like, he's sitting down at a studio.
Yeah.
He knew he was about to be on TV. About to start talking about energy.
Wants to be in Parliament.
Like, you got to be across your brief a little bit.
Who's the, what's the staff member that's chucked him up to?
Yeah. Oh, this is a good idea. Yeah. Just go on and talk about this.
Go on, Spears.
Yeah.
You know, it's like electricity.
David Spears is the easiest guy in the world. Like, yep. He never asks a follow-up question.
Yep.
And David Spears is an absolute expert of the bafflement. Like, he really looked disappointed.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, really out of the head. Anyway, we should stop having a go at this guy because he's now one of our clients. So, he's come to the James and Pete PR Factory and he wants to know what he can do next time or how he can spin this into a win. Do you have any ideas?
Oh, I do. I don't reckon he's too far off the mark.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we'll get the private sector to do it.
Yep.
And the taxpayer won't have to.
Yep.
And they're not doing it.
But they could.
Yeah. So, you know.
No, you just reckon double down.
You're hitting all the right marks. Yeah, don't surrender. Don't apologise.
Just say it with more confidence.
Yeah.
Because there's like, there's an actual moment. Like, if you got to see the video, it's going around on Twitter. There's an actual moment where you can just see him go, uh-oh. Like, yeah. His eyes just go.
I don't know.
Oh, dear.
I don't know.
What all right.
So he's not far off. He just needs to not apologise and just go, David, they're not.
Yeah.
They're not though,
do
they?
The Trump. Just gaslight. Just yeah. Go even harder as yeah. To what you just
you're
said.
You're the enemy of the people, David.
You're the enemy of the people.
This is the problem.
Yeah. You're terrible. You're rude.
Yeah.
And then revoke his press pass. Yeah. Cool. My plan would be that this guy, just from now on in any interview, just has a smoke grenade in his pocket.
Okay.
Just, he has it there. And if he's ever caught out like that again, just let off the smoke grenade. Big cloud of smoke. When it disappears, he's gone.
Oh, just a trick of the trade.
Just a trick of the trade. I'm just saying, just have the smoke bomb on hand.
Yep.
Done. No,
that's good. That's yep. the kind of way it's what we bring to the table is experience.
Yeah. What I do is charge clients thousands of dollars for intrigue, and then I just give them a $5 smoke grenade. My overheads are amazing.
Just go on the front foot and own the narrative. That's my narrative.
Let off a grenade. Now, that is it for the show this week. So thanks again to Maxim Beshev and Luke Kazanov for those really interesting interviews. Make sure you you're subscribing to the IPA Review as part of becoming an IPA member if you want to read Maxim's articles and all the other great stuff that is in the IPA Review. That's all I've got. So thank you guys so much for listening and subscribing to this podcast. We are available on iTunes, Spotify, through the IPA website, anything that people can listen to podcasts on, we are there. So make sure you're telling your friends and family about that, because we do want all of the people to listen to this podcast, and the more they are listening, the better. And if you are listening on iTunes, make sure you're leaving us that 5-star rating. It does help us out with the iTunes rankings. You can also leave a comment, tip for the show, something you want us to discuss, maybe an old segment you want to see brought back. Pete is smirking.
What's some PR advice?
Some PR advice. Maybe, yeah, if you have your own issue with PR and you want the James and Pete PR Factory to help you out,
yeah.
I know a place where you can buy smoke grenades. But anyway, Nina, if people want to become a member of the IPA so that they can subscribe to the IPA Review and all of the other brilliant stuff that the IPA does, where can they go?
Well, just visit the website, ipa.org.au, and click on the join button, and starting as low as $22 per year, you can become one of the loudest voices of freedom in Australia.
Very cool. See you guys next week.
See ya. You know I cherish you, my love. I cherish you.